I need to know everything. Who and the what and the where. I need everything.
Trust me. Hello and welcome to JK Plus One. I am not your host, PTF. I think he's in the UK somewhere. And what was he doing the other day? I don't know what he was doing. I guess he was watching those horses jump over those fences. And then did something else too. He went to the theater. Seems like a thing Pete would do with his hat on when he's in London, go to the theater. I just want to know if Pete picks up like a British accent when he's over there. If he starts saying, you know, calling people mate and things like that. Anyways, I am your host, Jonathan Kinchin. This is a fun episode. And look, it's March Madness. You guys got games to watch. You got brackets to be upset about. Hopefully only one of them. I say brackets. I don't mean because there's brackets in a bracket. I don't mean you have multiple pages that you picked different teams winning championships. Oof. That's like the worst form of redboarding. But it's a great topic for this week. Before I get to our guest and what this show is all about, I want to thank our friends at Qatar Racing for the support. Look, I'm excited. I had just a touch on my not quite in the top 10 list that we have, but man, one more good performance out of him, and he's right there in the mix. A horse I think is very interesting in this year's Kentucky Derby, so we wish our friends at Qatar Racing all the luck in the world. Now, on to our guest. This is an episode, and you know, look, when I started to do JK Plus One, these types of episodes were in the mix, and ideas. You know, I think the second episode I ever did is still, to this day, and if you've never listened to it, go back and listen to it now, it is still the most listen to episode on the In the Money Media Network, and that is Duke Matisse. When I had Duke Matisse on telling gambling stories of his life as a professional horse player, this episode is right up there with it. Frank McGoey, a semi-professional. I think if you do it every day and your tax returns have to account for it, I think you can consider yourself a professional. And Frank McGoey, a New Orleans legend in his own right, is just out here telling stories, the fun stuff you like to hear when it comes to the gambling stories and the ideas around this game that we love from the betting side of it. So enough of me chatting. Hope your bracket is doing well. Let's jump in here on Louisiana Derby weekend with Frank McGoey. Frank, what's going on?
Hey, Jonathan. Good to talk to you. It's been a minute.
It's been a while. Yeah, it's been a while. I'm trying to think the last time I saw you, Saratoga, maybe?
Absolutely. Yeah. On the annual Saratoga trip, which is now, you know, entrenched in the calendar permanently. All the guys on that trip love it. And it's a lot of fun. We look forward to it every year.
What weekend do you guys usually go?
So we'll be back this year, Jim Dandy. We had to switch it up last year and come the first week. But what is Jim Dandy? Third week?
Second or third. Weekend is like what, Diana? Second weekend is Coaching Club American Oaks. Maybe third weekend is Jim Dandy. That sounds about right.
I think that's it. Yeah. So we'll be back. We had gone Jim Dandy a few years in a row, and then we had to switch it up last year because somebody had a conflict. But we'll be back Jim Dandy week, and you know, I just got to cross your fingers for the weather up there. But if it works out, it's a great trip and lots of fun, lots of laughs as usual.
Frank, for those who haven't heard you on these airwaves before, how would you describe your involvement with the game? Would you consider yourself a full-time professional bettor, or how would you describe it?
So, I would say yes. I dedicate more of my time to horses than I do my civilian gig. I do have a civilian gig. I've been having the same one for like 25, 27 years now. But I've got my customers, they all know what time post time is, and I've got them trained. So it better be something really important if they call me after post time. fortunately, it's an early kind of business. I work for a dairy processor, and so deal with a lot of trailers going out to big broadliners like Cisco, Reinhardt, PFG, all those kind of places that are serving the restaurants and hotels of the world. But then I've got a bunch of school routes that I oversee too, guys out serving schools milk. So those guys start early. So, you know, like this time of year, right now at Fairgrounds, with Fairgrounds running, My day will start about 4, and from 4 to 5, I'll catch up and make sure things are going out and on their way in the milk world. Then I'll head over to the fairgrounds on race days and clock from 5:30 to 10, and then try to cram a whole day's rest of my work in before post time at 12:45. And then it's kind of hectic. You know, this is the last week. I'm looking forward to a little break after that. But I like doing it, and it sets me up for the rest of the year. I get a good line on these horses going forward. We don't always have the best betting opportunities at the fairgrounds, but there'll be a lot of opportunities with these horses that go to Keeneland and Churchill, then on to Saratoga, and, you know, even the Louisiana breds that stay down here. The L.A. tracks is, you know, where I pay my bills. So that'll help throughout the whole year. So it sets me up. It's a lot of work, but I wouldn't do it if I didn't love it.
So do you play from the track then?
No, I play from my house.
Yeah. Oh, you come home then. So you're out there and then you come home.
Correct. Yeah. If I'm out at the track.
Do you ever play from there?
You know, if I go to the track, it's more of a social thing. I can't concentrate unless I'm. So right now when I'm talking to you, I'm sitting at my desk. I've got 4 TVs on, Gulfstream, Fairgrounds, Tampa, and whatever TVG show. And I got, you know, my double screens up and I can watch replays, checking odds. This is where I can bet. I can't bet if I'm at the track. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you do it, if you do it on set when you're out there, but I can imagine it's, you know, got to be kind of distracting. That's the way I feel like when I'm at the track. I go to the track for social stuff. Even when I go to Saratoga on that trip, I don't think I made 5 bets the whole weekend. If I do, I'm just betting races. And I find myself betting way more races these days than pick 5s or pick 4s and stuff like that. I'd rather just beat up a race.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm on set, I usually will, you know, put a pick 5 in before I go on, or you know, if it's a race I love, I'll try to get that in early. It's impossible to try to do it, you know, during. I mean, don't get me wrong, I've successfully pulled it off at times, right. but it's tough.
It's distracting. It's distracting. I mean, I'm big. Part of my final decisions when I'm handicapping is using a post parade to see how horses look and how they're behaving, especially with young horses. And, I can tell better from watching it on TV than I can live, to be honest with you, just because you kind of train that way, you know, and you've watched more on TV. So, I mean, I'm just more comfortable here in my office doing it. And when I love being at the track and I love, you know, being out there with friends and having fun. I'm just not as serious about betting.
Tell me about your morning activities as a clocker, because, you know, we've got friends that are clockers, but that are like, you know, doing the official 4 Equibase clocking. You're actually out there really just gathering information for betting purposes.
Well, no, not now. Right now I'm a Churchill employee. So,
oh, you are? I didn't know that.
Yeah. So it morphed. So I was claiming some horses for myself. First horse I ever claimed was back in 2006 with my dad. He was getting on in age, and he was, I told him I was going to be claiming a horse, which I had no business claiming a horse. I didn't even own a house. So I was buying a horse, right? That was how I was thinking at the time. So he says, I want to go in with you. So we claimed the 0-for-19 maiden, from Louisiana Downs. And my thinking behind wanting to get involved with it was slots had just gotten approved at Delta Downs in Vinton. And the horses were getting ready to leave Louisiana Downs at Shreveport. And the bottom for L.A. bred maiden claimers at Shreveport was 5,000. And the bottom at Delta was 10. But it was all going to be the same horses running. They were just going to be running for 10. And the pot was going to be like 19,000 with the slot money they had. Whereas Louisiana Downs, I think the purse was like 11,000. So it just made sense. So anyway, there was a horse that I knew a little bit about. I knew he had had some talent. He was, I won't mention any names, but he was with a trainer that couldn't train Lassie to bark. And I knew there was a little more potential there. So I asked my dad if he wanted to go in half with me. And we claimed an 0-for-19 maiden called Mint Flight, who I gave to a guy named Scotty Tubbs. A guy that used to work for Van Berg. He actually galloped Ellie Sheba back in the day. And Eddie Johnson, the late Eddie Johnson, who I was friends with down here, he put me on him. He, you know, I went to Eddie to see if he wanted to take the horse, and he said, no, I'm not going to Delta. He said, but call this guy Scotty Tubbs. He's a good guy. So I called him, and we claimed the horse, and he called me, you know, so we got the horse, and says, you know, he looks okay. I'll let you know. I said, well, spend a little money. Let's get him straight. And I told him what the plan was. You know, we want to run Maiden 10 at Delta. So like 3 weeks later, on a Saturday morning, my pager goes off. So I see the 318, the Shreveport area code. And I said, oh, this can't be good. So I call him, and he called me City Slicker. He was real country. He said, City Slicker. He said, you got to do me a favor. I said, what's that? He said, I weigh 147, and I just worked your horse. And he worked 48 flat. He said, they got a maiden special weight race opening night at Delta. I want to run in that one. I said, no fucking chance. Are you going to embarrass me with the first horse? I'm, you know, claim one for five. We're going to run a maiden special weight. He said, man, you can put it on me. He just kept begging me. So, Jonathan, finally I give in. Talk to my dad. My dad says, man, whatever the guy says, you're paying him to train. Let him train. So we go up there on early part of November in 2006, and the horse went off 16-1, and I bet like 200 to win on him, just because he was my horse. And he wound up paying $32. Won that night, and then won back like 3 weeks later, and another 3 weeks after that. So I mean, it was an incredible run, and that's how I kind of got started in the horses. So then fast forward, we wound up losing him, and then a few years later, I was going out to fairgrounds, because I had my owner's license. I would go out to fairgrounds in the morning, just looking for horses that were training well, that might be in it, that I might be able to claim for myself. And I knew Mike Deliberto, the head clocker out there, for years. I mean, he's been a head clocker. He was at Jefferson Downs before they closed, and he's been at the fairgrounds for a long time. And he knew I was down there. And, you know, I got used to all the saddle towels and stuff like that, and knowing who I wanted to watch. And then it kind of just morphed into, well, okay, it's 2 weeks before the Risen Star. I know these guys are going to be out there working their prospects in the first or second set first thing in the morning, or the first or second set after the break. So I would go out there on my own. Well, one thing led to another, and they were shorthanded. You know, Churchill was with real clockers, and he said, hey, are you interested in being a clock? And I said, well, you know, I don't think I can do it full time. I can't leave my regular gig. I said, but I might be able to help you on race days when there's more jocks at the track, and then again, have more, you know, workers. And he said, oh, what? That, he said, that might work. And he said, you need to okay it with your people. I said, no. I said, I think as long as I handle my business, they don't care what I do. So that's how it started. So for the last couple of years, the last three years, I've been on as Churchill employee, as a clocker during the fairgrounds. Oh,
I had no idea. That's awesome. That's fun.
But I really got the best of both worlds, because it is grueling and it's grinding every day. But I mean, I have to, there are a couple of days I need to get some work stuff done for the other gig. So just doing it on race days is like perfect. It's a perfect balance for me right now.
How much of your handle, like, do you believe, the percentage wise, of course, percentage of your handle you think is strongly influenced by what you're seeing in the mornings versus what you're seeing on paper?
So it's changed. A buddy of mine, Billy Pettengill, who used to be a clocker, has been clocker at a number of places. He told me something, and I realized that, he said, sometimes we see too much in the mornings. So you got to kind of, once I started doing it, there is kind of a learning curve as to what your sweet spot is with watching works. And I try to avoid betting on horses strictly on works. I love it when what I see on paper falls in with what I see in the morning, that the horse is really doing good physically. Doesn't have to be a great work. I just want to see that they're fit and happy and look forward in the way they're galloping or training. Because, Jonathan, 95% of these works we see are nothing more than exercise. But then, 5% you're going to see serious works and you're going to see some level of talent. But most of the trainers, they don't want to show all their talent in the morning because they don't get paid to show their talent in the morning. So you got to kind of find a mix. And first-time starters, it's tricky because it's really all about how they handle things on race day. They can show up in the morning and be, you know, lightning bolts in the morning. But if they don't handle the gate, they don't handle the paddock, and I've seen a number of them, you know, show us everything right in the morning, then show up at the gate and lose it, or show up in the paddock and lose it. And, you know, they really show what they're capable of their second time more than their first time. To have a first-time starter win and win impressively, you got to be a pretty special horse, is what I've learned. So I would think percentage-wise, it's probably 65% of the things I'm betting on are have something to do with what I've seen integrated into what I've handicapped, and maybe 35 is, you know, straight one way or the other, straight handicapping or straight, I'm just going to take a shot on this horse that worked good the first time, something like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. Do you stay pretty involved when they leave fairgrounds and go back to some of the smaller racetracks with Louis? I mean, I know you're looking at those races. Are you still betting them at the same amount? Or
absolutely. I bet Louisiana Downs and Evangeline quite a bit, even though, I mean, I know I'm not looking to make scores. I'm looking to make rebate and looking to make a profit. But, I mean, these horses, I mean, I don't know if there's a Louisiana-bred horse that stayed his career in Louisiana that I haven't seen every one of their races and done taking trip notes on them, you know?
Right.
So I've got an edge with those kind of horses. And, yeah, they help pay the bills. I mean, I bet those year-round. So, yeah, and that's a great, great line on those horses, the new crops that come in, the two-year-olds that turn three at the fairgrounds. I'm going to get to see them and get a line on them as they leave here and go on to Evangeline, Louisiana Downs throughout the summer. Now, back in the old days, Louisiana Downs, I mean, you could make scores back in the 80s. I mean, it was first place that had $1 million pick six carryover. But it's a different game now. You know, race cards with seven races and eight, nine horse fields. I mean, you're looking at grind out exact as it paid $25 to $30, stuff like that. And you're just looking to get some churn. You know,
is there a reason
it's really turned into, I mean, I don't, so you're in a different, little bit different being at Saratoga every day, where every day is a weekend, but yeah. I'm guessing I haven't been following Fox. Are you still working the aqueduct stuff?
Yeah.
So, I mean, those weekday cards, they can't be much, right? It's like the whole country seems like it's turned into a weekend game for the most part.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Is there anything in particular that's kind of, is it just, do you think that it's happened kind of everywhere? Is there anything in particular that's kind of led to some of the smaller tracks in Louisiana kind of, you know, having those seven race cards?
We have full crop. I mean, you know, back in the 80s, it was 50,000 probably at its max. And now it's probably 18 to 20, you know, and oil was booming back then. And then when it dropped off, it became, It hurt Louisiana racing for sure. And then, you know, these racetracks tied to casinos, I mean, it would really help in Louisiana if we managed our dates better, because we've got four tracks that for the most part compete against each other. This month right now, Delta's not competing with fairgrounds. So all the Louisiana bred races at fairgrounds have full fields right now. But, you know, when Delta was running, the Louisiana bred races wouldn't fill, or they would fill with smaller fields. So, I mean, most of these tracks would rather just operate their casinos than run racing meets. I don't see why they don't just get together, divide their dates equally, and we could have fuller fields and better handle and better racing. It's not that complicated.
You know? It's not.
We've got too much racing, and we, just as an industry, I scratch my head sometimes the way we manage it. And I'll tell you, I mean, I love this game, but I was one of the things I noticed when I was in Vegas this past week at the NHC, you know, we stood up every day for the national anthem, and I'm looking around the room and I see way too many old guys like me. We need some young blood. This is the greatest game there is. It's a mental challenge, keeps people sharp. It's exciting. You wake up every day looking forward to it. At least, you know, I do. Even when I get beat up one day, you know, I wake up, I'm like, all right, I respect the process. I get right back in it. I respect the process. I watch a lot of replays. I do my work. And if you put yourself in a position to get lucky enough, you'll get lucky every now and then. You know, but I wish more young people felt that way instead of betting every play on their phone on football, because as long as 11's more than 10, they got no shot at that game. Well, it's true. You know?
No, I'm with you. Louisiana Derby Day. Do you anything different for you? Do you get out there for Louisiana Derby Day, or you be at the house as well?
I will go out in the afternoon for the last few. So that's this weekend. And then Sunday's the final day. I'll go out there Sunday. They have 14 races with just a bunch of friends and hang out in the paddock bar. I'll try to have some ideas. I may put a few bets in, but, you know, nothing serious. It's like I said, when I'm out there, it's more of a social event.
I've always heard about the oysters in the paddock bar at Fairgrounds. Is that true or false?
Well, they don't have many more. They used to. So let me tell you, I started going to the track. You don't remember the old fairgrounds, the old wooden building. I mean, the old fairgrounds was very similar to Saratoga. Reminds me a lot of Saratoga. Wooden structure. It was great. I can still walk through it. In my mind, I can still walk through every section of it, and I can see the same characters where they would be in the same places and smell the same smells that I remember, you know, when you turned each corner where you had, they were cooking corned beef, or you had Miss Shirley had a soup kitchen. I mean, they had the oyster bar down in the paddock. The place was, it was amazing. So I remember my parents taking us out there to see a horse called A Letter to Harry, who was a local fan favorite. I think he won a New Orleans handicap in the late 70s, 78, 79. And I believe he was trained by John Oxley. I know he was owned by the Salmon, Sandra Salmon and her family. But anyway, I remember going out there with my brothers and my dad for that. And I remember that first visit. And then when I got in high school, or I might even have been in high school, maybe I had a freshman at the time. But later on in high school, my best friend growing up's uncle was a track superintendent. And he also was in charge of stalls, you know, allocating stalls to the trainers. And at the old fairgrounds, his office was right next to the paddock. So these trainers would leave the paddock. They'd come to his office. We'd be hanging out in his office with him. He had a bar in there. They'd come get a drink. And if they liked their horses, they'd tell him. And he had us set up with one teller that we could go to, even though we were underage. And she knew we were betting for him. And he'd give us a little taste if he won. So I remember being in there. When Bud Delp would come in, give him horses, he was tight with Bud Delp. He was Thomas Skiffington came in town a few times with horses. He gave him horses to bet on. I remember being in there in, I think, early 80s when Lucas brought Balboa Native in town to win the Louisiana Derby. And it might have been the first horse Lucas ran at Louisiana. And we were in the infield with him with that horse. And, you know, I just fell in love with it. I mean, that's how I started at the fairgrounds. But the old building was great, and I miss it a lot. I remember it was 1993, I believe, is when it burned down. It was a Friday night. I was watching it on TV, and I didn't believe what I was seeing. I had to get in my car and go over there and see it. We went racing 3 weeks later.
What happened?
They had a fire up in the jocks room. Some kind of electrical fire above the jocks room. And it was a Friday night, and they started racing that night that afternoon at 3. They used to have these incredible Friday afternoon cards. They had a chef from Lafayette named Carol Angel. He was friends with all the jockeys, Shane Sellers, Alvarado, Mark Guidry. Alvarado may have been a little young for that time. Mark Guidry. Eddie Delahousse, this guy, they all grew up together. And Carol Angel was an unbelievable chef. They had the best Friday seafood buffet in the whole city. Fairgrounds was packed on Fridays. I mean, packed. And it was packed this Friday. It was a Friday in December. And people left the track at like The last race ended at like 7:45 or something like that. And an hour later, it was burning. And it just, it went up fast. I mean, it was like, you know, the Hindenburg just from one end to the other, totally destroyed. So then 3 weeks later, because we were, because of their association with the Jazz Fest, they were able to work with the Jazz Fest producers and find a contact with these big tents to set up these big tents. And Brian Krantz owned a track at the time. And, he, you know, he told the horsemen, he said, listen, we're going to be up and running. And he gave him a date. I think it was like three and a half weeks. And they started running again in temporary tents 3.5 weeks later. It was crazy. Yeah. Wow.
Frank, as someone who's been around the track as long as you have and playing as long as you have, you got to have some good stories. I know the derbies are big for you. I know that Patrick's Breeders' Cup, your brother Patrick's Breeders' Cup betting challenge success was good. Wherever you want to go with it, maybe you want to do derbies, you want to do Breeders' Cup, your call.
I'll give you a little derby history. So, first derby I went to was, I went on my own. Well, not on my own, with two other guys. We decided last minute we were going to the derby. Because you know the stake they run on Oaks Day now, the 2-year-old stake, the WHAS. That there was a TV station in Louisville. I don't even know if they call it now.
The 2-year-old dirt race, right? For Phillies or Colts or what? It's one of them. I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, they run it on Friday now. They run it on Oaks Day now, I think, or maybe even they run it on Thurby.
I think it's Thursday, but I know what you're talking about.
Thursday. So they used to run that race on Derby Day. And on the undercard. And that was a big deal because these guys with these 2-year-olds down here in the Cajun country, they used to have them all cranked up, ready to go. So we went up, me and two of my buddies drove up because we knew about a Bernie Flynn horse that had worked 34-1 down here. And he was going up there to run in that race. So we jumped in the car. We jumped in my friend Silica. I don't even know if we had a change of clothes. So we're going to Derby. And we stopped in Mobile at the Mobile race course, which at that time, they weren't racing thoroughbreds anymore. They were racing greyhounds, but they were still simulcasting. And we were on the verge of turning around and coming back because we were getting ready to lose all our money at Santa Anita. And there was one race left, and we hit with some Ron McAnally horse in the last race, and we're able to keep going to Louisville. So we get up to Louisville, I mean, Churchill was unrecognizable. Like, if you saw what it was back in 91 compared to what it is now, I mean, you would not even believe it's the same building. There was not much to it at the time. And we were able to, you know, no problem getting tickets, walking right in. And we, on Oaks Day, we made a few bucks. But then the last race, I think it's the year that MC Hammer, the rapper, had Light the Oaks, and one of my friends liked that horse a lot, but for some reason he didn't bet on her or something. He screwed it all up. So that night we're back at the hotel. We're staying at a motel, not a hotel, on Dixie Highway, like right around the block from the track, right down the block from Deja Vu Strip Club. And so I was like, "Come on, let's go. We're going out. It's Friday night." And they're like, "Nah, we're not going out." I said, "Give me the keys. I'm going out." So I take his car. And I roll into the parking lot at Deja Vu Strip Club. There's nowhere to park around the front. I roll around the back. And you know that scene from Animal House where the Playboy bunny comes flying off the float right into the kid's room? You ever seen that? That's what it was like. This drunk stripper comes stumbling out of the back door. I guess her shift was over. She walks right up to my car and says, "I need a ride." I said, "Get in." So I haven't been gone 10 minutes. Now I'm back at the motel. I'm knocking on the door. They're like, "What did you forget?" And I open the door with this stripper. It just added to the derby story. So anyway, long story short, great. That was my great first derby experience. I bet on Best Pal. I got run over by Chris Antley and Strike the Goal with Zito the next day. So then, you know, I didn't go to the derby for a number of years. And I got to be friends through my old Little League coach, this guy Frank Mowbray, who had moved to Baton Rouge. He was friends with Joe Dean, who was the athletic director at LSU. and Alan Copping, who was the president of LSU. And these guys had been going to the Derby for years. Joe Dean was, he was a big Indiana basketball guy. He was like Mr. Indiana basketball 2 years in a row in high school. And he had been a guest of Paul Hornings and at the Derby one, a couple of years. And finally one year, Horning apparently was getting destroyed. And they what they called a suite back then, I don't even know how to explain it to you. If you were walking through the tunnel on the second floor, like, you know the steps you go downstairs to the paddock at church, I mean, to the winner's circle at Churchill. So, you know, they have those little like caves on an incline. They used to have curtains and they would call those suites. And that was like, they didn't have many suites back then. So Paul Hornung apparently had one of those, was getting buried. He's like, I'm never coming back here again. And Joe Dean says, well, Paul, if you really feel that way, can we go get the suite in my name? He's like, absolutely. And he walks Joe Dean to the office at Churchill and he puts it in Joe's name. Joe made 45 derbies in a row before he passed away. So anyway, I got to meet Joe Dean and I started giving him some horses. And so he invites me on a derby trip. And so I went up in 2006. Barbaro was the first year that I went on that trip with them. And I think it was one of the first years that TVG started doing their work show. Remember when they would show you the works a week out? And when I saw Barbaro's work, I knew I was seeing something different, the way that horse moved. I had seen him run his Florida Derby, and I think he won his Florida Derby, or he got beat by Romans. It was close, whatever it was. But I remember going up there on that trip with those guys, and I told everybody from the week out that that I'd seen his work, that horse wasn't losing the Derby. And then when he won, I was a big hit with all the guys on the trip. They wanted me back the next year. And the next year was Street Sense. And I can't take all the credit for that because John Nichols told me Street Sense work was great that year. And so I wound up falling on that winner. And so then after that, I said, you know what? I got to get my brother on this trip because I started to corrupt him and get him involved with horse racing. So the year of Big Brown, we put together our own thing. And what started as just four guys on their own, we wound up getting a box outside from somebody. And, you know, that's back in the day where you were handicapping in the box, having to run to the window to bet. I mean, it was crazy where we've come. That transformed into this trip where we had like 12 guys, like eight standing guys on the trip, regular guys, and like four. We had a waiting list of four open spots where we would bring different people. And that's when I would see you up there in the goal room. And that was crazy. And so here's a great, so the Mind That Bird year, that's a pretty good story too. So I like Pioneer of the Nile that year. I thought he was the horse to beat. And we were at Roost Chris on Thursday night, the whole gang of us. And that year I had brought not only my brother Patrick, but my two civilian brothers that aren't involved in horse racing, my older brother Tommy and my youngest brother Paul. And my oldest brother Tommy is so by the book, if I told him I fixed the race, he might bet $20, right? So, I mean, he's not betting on anything, but he wanted to come to the Derby. He was up there. So we're at dinner that Thursday night. And one of the guys I had told to put a future book bet on Birdstone a few years before. So he remembered this. And he says, what about this horse, Mind That Bird? And the exact words out of my mouth were, you have a better chance of meeting God on this trip than that horse winning. Right? So, you know, everybody laughs, but, you know, he's not forgetting this. This horse is still in his mind. So the next morning is Friday morning, and we're staying at the Executive East out by the airport, and I'm down in the business center, printing racing forms, is doing something. And there's two guys and a girl come in the business office, and one guy, you kind of tell he looks like a trainer. He's got on jeans and cowboy boots, and he's got like, you know, some kind of gear that you – a trainer would wear. The other guy's an older guy, and he's got a smoking hot young Asian girl with him. And this guy comes over, he sees me looking at the form. He comes over to me and says, "Hey, you look like you know what you're doing." I said, "Well, I tried to." And he says, "Does my horse have a shot in the Derby?" I said, "Well, who's your horse?" He said, "Musket Man." And I said, "Wow." I said, "You know what? I was just looking at him." I said, "You drew well." I said, I don't think you're my first choice, but I said, "You can definitely get a piece with a good ride. I think he got some upside." He said, "That's good to know." He said, "We're going out there to see him train. I'm going to let you know how he does." I said, "All right." I said, I'll be down here." I said, "I'm doing some work on tomorrow's card and I'll be ready to go." He says, "All right." So he goes off to the Derby to watch his horse train. And I'm handicapping that day. It was either for that day or for Friday. And I come upon Warrior's Reward, that horse of, was it Ian Wilkes?
Might have been. I think so.
And I just fall in love with the horse because on the stuff I use, I mean, he got to a number cutting back that was really good. Just looked like a really sweet spot. So Warrior's Reward had found that sweet spot where he was cutting back and had got to a number in his last route race internally that was better than anything had run in the race that he was coming up to, the 7-furlong race. But it wasn't going to show on, like, you know, buyer numbers or anything, just showing a 7-furlong speed figure. So I fall in love with this horse. And this lady had asked me, coming out of the hat store, they had a temporary hat store. She had come up to me where another friend of mine was there and said, "Hey, do you have a horse today?" And I said, "Yes, I like Warrior's Reward quite a bit." She wrote it down. She went and got a pen and wrote it down. I said, and then I start telling all my buddies on my trip. Now they're all getting up from, you know, they're late getting up and telling them, "Yeah, we're betting on Warrior's Reward." I'm telling them about meeting the guy that owns Musket Man and his smoking hot girlfriend, and that they're at the track and all this stuff. So that they're all excited. So now, you know, everybody's getting excited. We all get dressed and we get ready to leave for the track. And here comes Vic Carlson, the guy that owned part of Musket Man, with his girlfriend, the knockout. And I said, "Vic," I said, "man," I said, "come on over. Let me introduce you. I was telling everybody about you." So he, nice as can be, this guy comes on over. He's got the girl with him. And he says, "You know, she's the reason that the horse is called Musket Man." We're like, "Really?" "Yeah." He goes, "We started going out. I had to slow it down." I said, "Sweetheart, I'm a musket man. You can load me up and fire me once a day. That's it. I can't go all day. I'm old." So we are dying laughing, right? And then he goes, I said, "Well, what took y'all so long to get back? That was like 5 hours ago." He said, "Yeah." He said, "We had a little problem. We got a little accident on the backstretch. This guy backed into my car." He says, "But he was nice as could be." He said, "Why not not call anybody?" He said, "He even gave me a horse to bet on." He said, "He's got his jockey's Calvin Burrell. His name was Jerry Hissom. And he's riding this horse, Warrior's Reward." He said, "Make sure we bet on that horse. That horse is going to win." My group looked like they saw a ghost when he said this, because I've been talking about this horse all morning. So when Warrior's Reward went from last on the backside to first at the 16th pole, which is kind of pretty much where we were, the box we were in just went crazy. I know we cashed over $100,000. I mean, we were loaded up into him. He paid $980 that day, I think. And the rest of the trip just got better from there, because the next day, on Derby Day, when Vic is coming over in the walk from the backside with Musket Man, my cell phone's going off, and I go, I didn't recognize the number, and I'm calling him, and I'm like, "Who is this guy? Who is this number?" And I answered it. And he answered, "It's Vic, Frank, where are you?" And he's walking over with this horse, and he's wanting to look at us and wave at us. So everybody in the box, my horse was Pioneer of the Nile, and everybody now is using Musket Man in everything. And the one guy that had asked me two nights before says, "We're including Mind That Bird in everything we do." And we're making group bets at the time. And you, to make a group bet, you got to go, "All right, I'm putting in a try. Everybody give me 20. Everybody, because you had to run to the window and all this. So anyway, we wound up hitting a $4 try in the Derby. And when they hit the wire, we knew we had won it. We might have been the only people cheering because nobody knew who Monette Bird was. And we missed the super by a nose. I think Papa Clem ran fourth that year. I don't remember which way we had it, but I think we needed Musket Man second. Pioneer now ran second that year. Isn't that right?
Yeah, and Musket Man was third, yeah.
I think this crazy lunatic bet that this guy made with the two horses, you know, with Minette Bird and Musket Man, we were going to hit the super. And the way it came, that was the year I think Cooper Gooding Jr. hit it, and it paid over $1 million. It might have paid $2 million our way. It was crazy. So the brother, my oldest brother that I told you, you know, if I told him I was fixing a race, he'd bet $20. He's wins like 3,000. So he's all excited. And he's, I'm coming back next year. I said, no, you're not. You're done. I said, it never gets any better than this. You can only be disappointed. You're never coming on another horse racing trip. Yeah. Get over it. So,
oh my gosh,
that's all. That's true. I mean, it's crazy. It is it's crazy Derby stories. What else? Trying to think.
Tell me about the holster bet.
Oh, the holster bet. So I think I mentioned this bet. I told somebody I was making a holster bet. I think he might have even told Pete this. He said, "What's a holster bet?" Well, there was back in the '80s. There was a guy that was a security guard at the fairgrounds, Joey Finacci. Joey Finacci, and on his off days from being a security guard. Now let me give you a picture of Joey. 5'3", 240. Okay, you got it. Now picture this: on his off days, he's got a wetsuit in the back of his car, and he goes around to the public golf courses and dives into lagoons to fish out the golf balls that are in there and sell them back to the driving range. Okay. This is Joey Finacci. Right. So remember I was telling you, everybody kind of stayed in the same spots in the track. Well, Joey was in one section, and where I used to sit, Joey was in that vicinity, and he knew some of the guys that used to hang out there, and he knew we would cash a few tickets every now and then. And there was this guy that came in town from Rockingham one year called Hugh Carney. He was a trainer. He wasn't familiar on the circuit. And he came with some live horses and somebody we knew who had gone to work for him. So they gave us a couple of horses and we all bet on him. And Joey's sitting there, he didn't bet. He didn't have any money. The guy would come by, we'd give him a little tip and tell him thank you. And he's like, man, the one next week's better than both of these. So the next week, I don't have to tell you what happens. The horse loses, but Joey had pawned his gun to bet on the horse. And so he walked around the rest of the fairgrounds meet with an empty holster. So he made an empty holster bet. So that's where that came from.
Oh, my gosh. I bet you never heard the end of that one, huh?
No, his sister was our favorite teller. I think his sister got him back straight some kind of way. I mean, back in the day, when you started going to the track, were you going to a physical track?
Yeah, I was Lone Star Park with my dad, but I was like 15, 15 years old. So, and he was just a gambler. He wasn't a horse guy. He wasn't like
looking
at the form. He was just betting our address every time. You know what I mean?
Gotcha. But Lone Star Park was relatively new. So the fairgrounds had been around so long that, I mean, it was just kind of entrenched in a lot of these guys' lives. Like when you pulled into the fairgrounds on a Thursday morning, there were 300 cabs parked there. Cab drivers that had been out pumping their cabs all night, making money so they could be at the track for the double and see if they could win. There were no pay phones at the track, Jonathan, when I started going there. And when pagers came out, the nearest payphone was like two blocks away at this little grocery store called La Coco's. They had double payphones. And, you know, guys would get paged by their wives, their bosses, their work, all kind of stuff. And they would all wait till they ran the race, and then there was a mad dash to get to the phone. You learned more about being a salesman waiting in line to hear what was going to come out of the guy in front of his mouth. It was unbelievable, the stories that were being told. Yeah, I got one more stop to make. I got to go see this guy. And I'm coming back to the office. Oh, yeah, honey, I had a flat tire. I'll be home soon. Yeah, the guy's fixing it right now. He's patching it. Yep. No, didn't need a new tire. I mean, it was just one lie after the other. It was hysterical. And then everybody would just hang up the phone, hand it to the next guy, and walk back to the track for the next race. I learned more about life and dealing with people, dealing with the characters and meeting all the people at the track. I mean, it was a great learning experience, you know? I think that's part of the reason that it's not as appealing to young people now, that they don't know that side of it. I mean, and, you know, I think that's one of the reasons that it's, you get such big crowds at Saratoga, because it's still part of the community. It's still part of the way people grow up in Saratoga. And it, yeah, unfortunately, like it's not bit. Other places, you know?
Yeah, you stand around at Saratoga long enough, you'll catch some, you know, you'll catch some good stories. Maybe not the maybe not the level of the holster bet, but you'll get some funny stuff happening.
But you also see everybody in the backyard, every table, well, for the most of the tables of people in the backyard, they've got a racing form and they're handicapping, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's got to be handed down from generation to generation too. Cuz it's just it's tough to learn it on your own. I mean, I'm not a reader. I've never been a reading guy, but I mean, anything about horses that I could get my hands on, I read. I'm one of many my age that started with the buyer books, picking winners and my $50,000 year and all that stuff. I mean, if you love it, you put the work in. And I've been
Coastal. Go ahead.
Now I say I've been fortunate, and you know, all the good things I have in my life have come from this game.
I love that. Ditto. I agree with you. Coastal Mar-a-Lago. Tell us about that story a little bit.
So I can relay this one. This will give you an idea. Like when I started going to the fairgrounds when I was young on my own, I was sitting at a table with two bookmakers, a cab driver, the husband of an unemployed husband of a millionaire who was my little league coach. Any other cast of characters, a number of who spent time in jail at one point or another. And so this story was passed on to me, and this is when I hear you and you hear something like this, and I wound up checking up on this a few years ago. It wound up being true. There was a horse. Well, Doc Carthill, I don't know if you ever heard of Doc Carthill. He was a notorious vet, that he had his shop was right on the backside of at Churchill, but he used to come down here for the winter. And the last race on Derby Day was always like some race that Doc Carthill would have something involved with, or something that they had been setting up for that race. So I don't know who owned the horse at the time, but they got their hands on this horse called Postal Milagro, M-I-L-A-R-G-O, I believe, P-O-S-T-A-L. And, you know, the last race was some kind of starter race for five or something. So the horse, they claimed the horse, or they got the horse. He was running for 20, and they moved him all around the country and held him. I mean, you know, there was no OTBs. There was just back in the day where it was pretty easy to hold a horse. So I think they wound up sending him to Suffolk, was the last place they held him for five. And then he shows up on the last race on Derby Day, 15-1 on the morning line with some bug boy. And this guy, Frank Mowbray, and his brother, Ronnie, was really one of the guys that taught me how to read the form. I remember he used to just yell and tell me, "You're looking at it, read it. And he taught me, read the form, read a horse from the bottom up, stop reading from the top down. So you can really get a picture of how a horse is developing. Start read at his oldest race and read from there up. And I never have forgotten this to this day. But anyway, so these two go up to the Derby, not to bet on the Derby, but to bet on this horse in the last race that they know they've been holding the whole year, getting ready for this. So they said jocks were coming out to ride the Derby, and they had to walk through this Visqueen tunnel. They had set up this tunnel coming from the jocks room to the thing, and they had cut holes in it, and they were handing people money. Handing their girlfriends or guys who were with money, saying, "Listen, don't bet on me in the Derby. Save this and bet on Postal Milagro in the last race." So right before the last race, they announced the change of rider. Bug Boy's off of Postal Milagro. Make the new rider Jimmy Combest, who was apparently like some decent journeyman jockey, may have even been good, but he wasn't a Bug Boy, right? The horse opens up 9-5. So from what Mowbray and the others tell me, he had five into the first turn, 15 on the backside, 20 turning for home. And when they hit the wire, you paid like $7 and was six in front. And they said, let's get out of here. So they wound up cashing their tickets. They go to, they meet up with Hard Hill and those guys after. My buddy Mubray tells Doc, he said, Doc, he said, man, I didn't know he was going to win like that. I would have bet more. And Doc Hard Hill tells him, son, when they ain't trying to catch you, bet all you can borrow. So they leave town, but apparently somebody from the Kentucky Racing Commission was upset. They figured out what was going on. But they had planned ahead for this because the guy they had listed as the trainer was a deaf, dumb mute who was like a hot walker on the backside. So they called this guy in, and all he could do was shake his head. I mean, they couldn't question him or anything. So all they could do was ban the horse from running in the United States ever again, and they did it.
Oh, my God.
So these are the kind of stories. I mean, this is, you know, like your reaction to it was mine. I was like, this is great. I want to be a part of this the rest of my life. So
it's exciting. I mean, I'm glad that those things aren't as prominent nowadays in a game that we were playing. But so
I'm gonna tell you another story though that taught me a lot about putting in the work too, Jonathan. This was really pretty important. Back in the day at Fairgrounds, the old racing secretary Mervyn Munoz, who we run a stake race for now, the Munoz Memorial, he used to require first-time starters to have a training race. He thought it was good for the public that they had a training race, you know, so that they would leave the gate fairly and stuff like that. Training races used to be on Wednesday mornings at 10 o'clock. And I was always in sales, so I had time to make it out there on Wednesday mornings at 10 o'clock, and I wanted to be there anyway, right? And then they would print up a sheet. They might run like five or six training races on a Wednesday. It would have the horse's name and the trainer's name. But the guys I was hanging with, they were pretty serious about what they did. They'd be out there and they'd be taking notes on how big the exercise rider was, if it was a jock or not, or if it, you know, somebody that weighed 150, if the horse had blinkers, if the horse had a tongue tie. And they were keeping track of all this stuff because it wasn't going to be published. There was no published, you know, it would just show up as a time in a training race. And you could tell some of the trainers, you know, they didn't want to have their horses in training races, but they were required to. Every now and then you could tell they were dragging one over that had been tranquilized, like he was about to get clipped or get new shoes or something like that. They just come dragging into the paddock. So you could tell all this stuff. So anyway, it's like 1 week left in the meet, and this trainer, Jose Fernandez, he ran a horse in a training race called Inner Peace, INNERPEACE. And this horse won by more than a 16th of a mile with a big exercise rider on him. And we had never heard of Jose Fernandez. We didn't know who he was. But we go and we talk to the grooms that are bringing the horse back after. Where's this horse going to run? And all the guy said was, he no run here. So luckily, one of the guys in that group that was a short-term investment broker, in other words, like if you wanted to invest in something with two halves or four quarters or nine innings, he'd be the guy you would call, right? he had a friend in Vegas, but more importantly, he had his wife work for Delta. So he told his buddy in Vegas, look, Fairgrounds is over. This horse isn't going to run here. I need you to start scouring entries around the country for him and let me know when he's in. And he wound up showing up on Labor Day or Memorial Day, forget what it was, at Hollywood Park in the second race. And he was in the one hole. And thank God, so the guy calls and my buddy jumps, and his wife gets him on a plane to Hollywood Park right across the street, to LAX right across the street. And he collected money from all of us to go out there and bet on this horse. And it was the only horse that won from the one hole going six furlongs, the whole meet at Hollywood that meet. Apparently, they had a really bad rail. The horse paid $72. So it taught me right there the value of putting in the work and you know, checking all things out. If you do the work, sometimes you put yourself in a position to be lucky. We were lucky that day.
Tell me a little bit about the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge success that your brother had, that I know you were obviously involved, helpful, you know, however you want to word it.
So, I like to refer to myself as Bernie Taupin. Somebody's got to be Elton John. Somebody's got to be Bernie Taupin. I'm fine being Bernie Taupin. I mean, he gets royalty checks, you know? He writes the music. Oh, he writes the words, and Elton writes the music. So I had qualified the year before, the year that Al Stahl won it with Blame. And that was at Churchill, too, I believe. And that was the first time I had gone to the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge. And I went, and I didn't do any good. But I remember telling Patrick, I said, man, you got to do this. This tournament's all right. So we both qualified the next year. And halfway through day one, Mott had a spectacular Friday. And I was like, you know what? I got to rethink some stuff tonight. I woke up. We were sharing a room. And I woke up at like 2:30 in the morning. I said, I'm going out in the lobby. I got to relook at some stuff. So I'm down there at like 6:30. And do you know Ray Arsenault, the guy that won the NAC?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I didn't know Ray at the time, but Ray was staying at our hotel, and he came down at like 6:30, go outside to take a smoke, and he's coming back in the lobby, and I don't know how we started talking. I said, Drosselmeyer is going to win the Breeders' Cup. And I had reasons. I can't remember all what they were. I know one of them was that, you know, Mike Smith had won on him the one time he won the Belmont. It was the only other time he rode him, and whatever. I had reasons for it. Sure enough, you know, we get to the last race, and Patrick had like 7,500 left, and he said, Drosselmeyer was 13-1. He said, I'm going to bet it all on Drosselmeyer. I said, you sure? He said, yeah. I said, hey, you know, he's 13-1. I said, I like him, but that's a pretty big bet. He said, nah. He said, he's really like 35-1. If we figure out how much we're going to make on the prize pool. I said, yeah. He goes, and you know what? This is going to change your life. And I said, let's go for it. And when we walked outside on the balcony, he said, when Source wins, just act like you've been here before. Well, I didn't, because when he turned for home and I saw him starting to unwind, I started going nuts. I was calling him a winner from the eighth pole. And when he got up, it was good stuff. It really was. So that was that. I mean, that was special, especially doing it, spending it with him. And then, you know, I don't know how we managed to repeat it the next year with Fort Larned. And he gets more credit for that because he really liked Fort Larned. He told me on the plane on the way out there, we were sitting next to each other, and he just kept saying, I keep coming back to Fort Larned. He's going to be the horse.
So. Look, I mean, I think it's pretty impressive. I mean, and for someone who was lucky enough to run second in the contest in back-to-back years, like winning it back-to-back years, that's insane. Yeah,
it is crazy. It is crazy. So, and now we get to keep trying it, right?
Yeah, get you another one. Get you another one. Before we go, Frank, I want you to tell, Patrick told me to ask you about Sports Beat.
Oh, so my I got three brothers, and they're all big golfers, and they're all members of different country clubs. And you know, they got their 19th hole or the men's grill or whatever they go after they play golf, and they hang out with guys that play cards, shooting and shit. So I'm not a golfer, right? And I'm not a member of a country club. So Sports Beat is where me and all my degenerate buddies hang out. But it's a lot of fun. Same kind of characters I would find at the racetrack, hang out there. You get some racetrack guys. Paul McGill hangs out there a lot when he's in town. Sam David, Sturgis Ducoin, a lot of the local guys. It's nothing special, but there's three dedicated TVs dedicated to horse racing all the time. They probably got 30 TVs in there with sports on and stuff. Good people, good laughs. I'll head over. So I usually go on Wednesday night and Friday nights. I'll go over there this afternoon when I get up, when we get wrap up. And I'll, you know, stay for a couple hours, talk to some people, have a few drinks, and just enjoy myself. But it's a fun joint. If you're in town, I'll bring you by there. You'd like it. Trust me.
I got to go. I've been trying to get my wife. We got to come down there to New Orleans. We were supposed to come. What was the big hurricane you guys had maybe 3 years ago?
Ida.
We were supposed to come then. We were going to drive down to Texas and Ida detoured us, so we didn't come. Yeah. That was the one time we were going to come. So we're going to do it at some point. We're going to get over there for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. They got some good food down here to rival hers.
There you go. Frank, if you got anything on your mind you want to get off about Saturday, Louisiana Derby Day, it's a big pool, so we won't mess you up too bad. Yeah. Anything you love?
I'm not in love with anything in the Derby. I think it's still kind of wide open. I started looking at it this morning. Hang on. Let me see. It would be an undercard, or maybe not an undercard. I like, you know what? I like Web Slinger quite a bit in the stake. And this is part of a little hate play too. I'm very busy. Beat me out of, at least 200,000 on, Pegasus Day. I had $1,000 exacta box, or I had $1,000 exacta warm heart over catnip at 45-1, and I had a $500 reverse catnip over warm heart. And I'm very busy, ran them down, and did it impressively. But I like the change. I like the post position change. Web Slinger is getting in that race, and Pratt's jumping on. I like that horse a little bit. Think he'll be decent at a decent price. And, I thought Gasoline may work out a nice trip, even though Best Actor was really good the other day. I thought there was some other speed where Gasoline might not have to go up where he was. If Touch Upon a Star stays in the race, if the Louisiana Bred stays in the race. Nothing crazy, but it's a good card. Lay up on. Oh, you know what? Yeah, I'll give you one. I got a crush on Intricate. How's that? In the Philly race.
There we go. Frank, yeah. We appreciate you taking the time. You're one of those guys we're going to have back again to keep telling stories. It made me feel like I was at the racetrack for the last hour. I appreciate you.
Don't you miss it? Oh. All right, brother. Be good. Good luck, everybody. All
right, we'll talk soon.
All right.
Oh, man. Look, I say it sometimes, and I say it again. This is going to be a repeat episode situation, right, where we're going to have we're gonna have Frank on again to keep telling these stories. I mean, I could just listen to him talk, to be honest. But wow, Musket Man! I'm gonna laugh about that for days. I mean, I liked the horse. Now every time I think about him, I'm gonna think about that. I want to thank our friends at Qatar Racing. Best of luck in the next couple of weeks on what's gonna happen with Just a Touch and where we're gonna go there. I want to thank them for their support and look forward to what they have going the rest of the year. Look, thanks you for listening. And hopefully you can pop this in between games. Hopefully your bracket is doing well. And we'll see you next week for Sweet 16, huh? Well, I don't know who we're going to have. Shoot me some comments, some emails, some text messages, some DMs, some tweets. Let me know who you guys want to hear on JK Plus One next week, and we'll try to make that happen. I appreciate you listening. We'll talk to you next week.
I need to know everything, who and the what and the where, I need everything. Trust me, I hear what you're saying, but I like it's new what you're telling me. I'm curious, George, I hop in the Porsche, 500 horse, I'm ready for war. I'm coming for throws to turn to a ghost, I need to know everything. Now you'll be surprised at the info you get is by letting them talk, so I'm letting them talk. Gotta keep quiet, maneuver.